emotions were the chemical consequences of experiences in her environment, and if she lived every day by the same emotions from her past, she was selecting and instructing the same genes that might be causing her poor health conditions. If she could instead embody the emotions of her future life by embracing those emotions before the experience actually happened, she could change her genetic expression and actually change her body to be biologically aligned with her new future. Anna did an additional meditation that involved resting her attention in the center of her chest, activating the ANS with those elevated states to create and maintain a very efficient type of heart rate we called a coherent heart rate, which I'll explain in detail later in the book, for extended periods of time. She learned that when she felt resentment, impatience, frustration, anger, and hatred, those states induce the stress response and cause the heart to beat incoherently and out of order. Anna learned in my workshops that once she could sustain this new heart-centered state, just as she had gotten used to feeling all of those negative emotions on a regular basis, in time, she could feel these new emotions more fully and deeply. Of course, it took quite a bit of effort to trade anger, fear, depression, and resentment for joy, love, gratitude, and freedom, but Anna never gave up. She knew that those elevated emotions would release more than 1,000 different chemicals that would repair and restore her body, and she went for it. Anna then practiced a walking meditation I designed in which she walked as her new self every day. Instead of sitting down and meditating with her eyes closed, she started these meditations standing up with her eyes closed. While standing, she got into the meditative state that she knew would change her state of being, and then while still in that state, she opened her eyes, staying in a meditative state, and walked as her future self. By doing so, she was embodying a new habit of thinking, acting, and feeling on a regular basis. What she was creating would soon become her new personality. She never wanted to go unconscious again and return to her old self. Because of all this work, Anna could see that her thought patterns had changed. She was no longer firing the same circuits in her brain in the same way, so those circuits stopped wiring together and started pruning apart. As a result, she stopped thinking in the same old ways. Emotionally, she began to feel glimpses of gratitude and pleasure for the first time in years. In her meditations, she was conquering some aspect of her body and her mind every day. Anna calmed down and became much less addicted to the emotions derived from stress hormones. She even started to feel love again, and she kept going, overcoming, overcoming, and overcoming every day on her way to becoming someone else. Anna grabs a hold of possibility. In May 2012, Anna attended one of my four-day progressive workshops held in upstate New York. On the third day, during the last of four meditations, she completely surrendered and finally let go. For the first time since she had started meditating, she found herself floating in an infinite black space, aware that she was aware of herself. She had moved beyond the memory of who she was and became pure consciousness, totally free of her body, of her association to the material world and of linear time. She felt so free that she no longer cared about her health conditions. She felt so unlimited that she couldn't identify with her present identity. She felt so elevated that she was no longer connected to her past. In this state, Anna had no problems. She left her pain behind, and she was truly free for the first time. She wasn't her name, her gender, her disease, her culture, or her profession. She was beyond space and time. She had connected to a field of information called the quantum field, where all possibilities exist. Suddenly, she saw herself in a brand new future, standing on a huge stage, holding a microphone, and talking to a crowd as she told them the entire story of her healing. She wasn't imagining or visualizing this scene. It was as if she got a download of information, a glimpse of herself as a totally different woman in a new reality. Her inner world appeared much more real to her than her outer world, and she was having a full-on sensory experience without using her senses. The moment Anna experienced this new life in the meditation, a burst of joy and light came into her body, and she felt relief on a deep, visceral level. She knew she was something or someone greater, much grander than her physical body. In this state of intense joy, she felt such delight and such immense gratitude that she burst into laughter. And at that moment, Anna knew she was going to be okay. From then on, she developed so much trust, joy, love, and gratitude that her meditations became easier and easier, and she began to go much deeper. As Anna moved out of her past, she felt this new energy opening her heart further and further. Instead of seeing her meditations as something she had to do every day, she started looking forward to them. It became her way of life. Doing the work became her habit. Her energy and vitality returned. She stopped taking antidepressants. Her thought patterns completely changed and her feelings were different. She felt like she was in a new state of being, so her actions changed drastically. Anna's health and life improved tremendously that year. The next year, she attended several more events. By keeping connected to the work, Anna started to develop relationships with more people in our community, and she received more and more support to keep her going on her journey back to health. Like many of our students, she sometimes found it challenging not to take a few steps back into the old programs and the old patterns of thinking, feeling, and acting once she returned home after a workshop. But even so, she kept doing her meditations every day. In September 2013, Anna's doctors gave her a very thorough medical checkup that included many different tests. 1 year and 9 months after a cancer diagnosis, and 6 years after her husband's suicide, Anna's cancer had completely healed and the tumor in her esophagus had vanished. Her blood tests showed no cancer markers. The mucous membranes in her esophagus, vagina, and anus were completely healed. Only a few minor problems remained. The mucous membranes in her mouth were still slightly red, although she no longer had any ulcerations. And because of the medication she had taken for the ulcerations, she still didn't produce saliva. Anna had become a new person. A new person who is healthy. The disease existed in the old personality. By thinking, acting, and feeling differently, Anna reinvented a new self. In a sense, she had become reborn in the same life. In December 2013, Anna came to an event in Barcelona with the friend who had introduced her to my work. After hearing me tell the participants a story about a remarkable healing of another student in our community, Anna decided it was time to share her story with me. She wrote it all down and gave the letter to my personal assistant. Like many letters I get from students, the first line read, "You are not going to believe this." After I read what she had written, the next day, I asked Anna to come up on stage and share her story with the audience. And there she was, a year and a half after the vision she'd had during her meditation in New York, unbeknownst to me, standing on a stage, talking to an audience about her journey healing herself. After the Barcelona event, Anna was inspired to work on her mouth even more. About 6 months later, I was lecturing in London, and Anna attended. I spoke in detail about epigenetics. Suddenly, a light went on for Anna. "I've healed myself of all these medical conditions, including cancer," she thought. "I should be able to signal the gene for my mouth to produce more saliva." A few months later, during another workshop in 2014, Anna suddenly felt saliva dripping in her mouth. Ever since then, Anna's mucous membranes and her saliva production have returned to normal. The ulcerations never came back. Today, Anna is a healthy, vital, happy, stable person with a very sharp and clear mind. Spiritually, she has grown so much that she goes very deep in her meditations and has had many mystical experiences. She is living a life full of creation, love and joy. She has become one of my corporate trainers, regularly teaching this work to organizations and companies. In 2016, she founded a successful psychiatric institution employing more than 20 therapists and practitioners. She is financially independent and earns enough money to live a rich life. She travels around the world, visits beautiful places, and meets very inspiring people. She has a very loving and joyful partner, as well as new friends and new relationships that honor both her and her children. When you ask Anna about her past health problems, she will tell you that having those challenges was the best thing that ever happened to her. Think about it. What if the worst thing that ever happened to you turns out to be the best thing that has ever happened to you? She often tells me that she loves her present life, and I always respond, "Of course you do. You created your life every day by not getting up from your meditations until you were in love with that life. So now you get to love your life." It was through the course of her transformation that Anna had, in effect, become supernatural. She had overcome her identity, which was connected to her past, and she literally created a new, healthy future, and her biology responded to a new mind. Anna is now the living example of truth and possibility, and if Anna healed herself, so can you. Getting mystical. Healing all sorts of physical conditions may be a very impressive benefit of doing this work, but it's not the only one. Because this book is also about the mystical, I want to open your mind to a realm of reality that will be just as transformative as healing, but that works on a deeper and different level. Becoming supernatural can also involve embracing a greater awareness of yourself and who you are in this world, and in other worlds as well. Let me share some stories about this from my own life to illustrate exactly what I mean and to show you what is possible for you too. One rainy winter evening in the Pacific Northwest, as I sat on my couch after a very long day, I listened to the branches of the tall fir trees outside my window filtering the gusts of wind through their canopies. My children were in bed, deep asleep, and at last I had a moment to myself. As I got comfortable, I began to review all the things I needed to accomplish the following day. By the time I'd made my mental list, I was too exhausted to think, so I just sat still for a few minutes, my mind empty. As I watched the shadows from the flames in the fireplace flicker and dance on the walls, I began to move into trance. My body was tired, but my mind was clear. I wasn't thinking or analyzing anymore. I was simply staring into space, being in the present moment. As my body relaxed more and more, I slowly and consciously let it fall asleep as I simultaneously kept my mind conscious and awake. I wouldn't let my attention narrow in on any object in the room, but instead kept my focus open. This was a game I often played with myself. I liked the practice because every once in a while, if everything lined up, I had very profound transcendental experiences. It was as if a door of sorts opened somewhere between wakefulness, sleep, and normal dreaming, and I slipped into a very lucid, mystical moment. I reminded myself to not expect anything, but to simply stay open. It took a lot of patience to not rush it or get frustrated or try to make something happen, but instead to slowly slip into that other world. That day I had finished writing an article about the pineal gland. After spending several months researching all the magical derivatives of melatonin that this little alchemical center had up its sleeve, I was overjoyed about linking the scientific world and the spirit world. For weeks my entire mind had been consumed with thinking about the role of the pineal metabolites as a possible connection to the mystical experiences most ancient cultures knew how to elicit such as Native American shamanic visions, the Hindu experience of samadhi, and other similar rituals involving altered states of consciousness. Some concepts that had been loose ends for years had suddenly clicked for me, and my discoveries left me feeling more whole. I thought I was one step closer to understanding the bridge to higher dimensions of space and time. All the information I had learned inspired me to a deeper awareness about what is possible for human beings. Yet I was still curious to learn more, curious enough to move my awareness to where the pineal gland existed in my head. I casually thought, speaking to the gland, "Where are you anyway?" As I rested my attention in the space the pineal gland occupies in my brain, and as I was drifting off into the blackness, suddenly, out of nowhere, a vivid image of my pineal gland appeared in my mind as a three-dimensional round knob. Its mouth was wide open in a spasm, and it was releasing a white milky substance. I was shocked by the intensity of the holographic image, but was too relaxed to be aroused or react, so I simply surrendered and observed. It was so real. I knew what I was seeing before me was my own tiny pineal gland. In the next instant, a huge timepiece appeared right in front of me. It was one of those old-fashioned pocket watches with a chain, and the vision was incredibly vivid. The moment I put my attention on the timepiece, I received very clear information. I suddenly knew that linear time, as I believed it to be, with a definite past, present, and future, was not the way the world really works. Instead, I understood that everything is actually happening in an eternal present moment. In this infinite amount of time, there exist infinite spaces, dimensions, or possible realities to experience. If there is only one eternal moment happening, then it makes sense that we would have no past in this incarnation, let alone no past lives. But I could see every past and future like I was looking at an old-fashioned piece of movie film with an endless number of frames, with the frames representing not single moments but windows of limitless possibilities that existed as scaffolding and went on in all directions forever. It was much like looking into two mirrors opposite one another and seeing infinite spaces or dimensions reflected in both directions. But to understand what I was seeing, imagine that those infinite dimensions are above and below you, in front and behind you, and to your left and to your right. And each one of those limitless possibilities already existed. I knew that by putting my attention on any one of those possibilities, I would actually experience that reality. I also realized I wasn't separate from anything. I sensed oneness with everything, everyone, every place, and every time. I can only describe it as the most familiar, unfamiliar feeling I've ever had in my life. The pineal gland, as soon as I understood I was being shown, serves as a dimensional timepiece that, when activated, can dial into any time. When I saw the hands of the timepiece move forward or backward, I understood that, like a time machine set to any particular time, there is also a reality or a dimension to experience in a particular space. This amazing vision was showing me that the pineal gland, like a cosmic antenna, had the ability to tune into information beyond our physical senses and to hook us up to other realities that already exist in the eternal moment. While the download of information I received seemed limitless, no words exist that can completely describe the magnitude of this experience. Experiencing my past and future selves simultaneously. As the hands of the watch moved backward to a past time, a dimension of space and time came to life. I immediately found myself in a reality relevant to me personally, although amazingly, that past moment was still occurring in the present moment I was experiencing while sitting on my couch in the living room. I next became aware that I was in a physical space at that specific time. I observe myself as a young child, again, while simultaneously having the experience of being the adult me on the couch. The child version of me was about 7 years old and had a very high fever. I remember how much I loved fevers at that age because I could go deep within and have the kind of abstract dreams and visions that often come with the delirium produced by high body temperatures. This specific time I was in my room in bed with the covers up to the bridge of my nose, and my mother had just left the room. I was happy I was alone. The moment she closed the door, I somehow innately knew to do exactly what I had just been doing in my living room as an adult, continuously relaxing my body and remaining somewhere between sleep and wakefulness as I stayed present to whatever came up. Up to this point in my present life, I had completely forgotten about the memory of this childhood experience, but when I lived it again in that moment, I saw myself in the midst of a lucid, conscious dream, comprehending possible realities like the squares on a chessboard. As I observed myself as this young boy, I was deeply moved by what he was attempting to understand, and I wondered how he could grasp such complicated concepts at his age. In that moment, as I watched him, I fell in love with that little guy, and the second I embraced that emotion, I somehow felt a simultaneous connection to both that point in time and the one I was experiencing as my present time back in Washington State. I had such a strong knowingness that what I was doing then and what I am doing now were happening at the same time, and that those moments were significantly connected. In that split second, the love I felt for him as my present self was drawing that young boy to the future I was living now. Then the experience got even stranger. That scene faded away, and the watch appeared again. I became aware that the hands of the timepiece could also move forward. Filled with a sense of wonder, and without any trepidation or fear, I simply observed the watch move forward in time. Instantaneously, I was standing barefoot in my backyard in Washington in the cold night. It's difficult to explain what time it was because it was the same night I was in my living room, but the me who was outside the house was the me from the future in that now. Again, words are limited here, but the only way I can explain this experience is that the future personality, called Joe Dispenza, had changed immensely. I was so much more evolved, and I felt amazing, euphoric in fact. I was so aware, or should I say as that person, I am so aware. By aware, I mean superconscious, as if all my senses were heightened 100%. Everything I saw, touched, felt, smelt, tasted, and heard was amplified. My senses were so elevated that I was acutely aware of and paying attention to everything around me, wanting to experience the moment completely. And because my awareness increased so drastically, so did my consciousness and therefore my energy. Feeling so full of this intense energy caused me to be more conscious of everything I sensed simultaneously. I can describe this feeling only as consistent, unwavering, highly organized energy. It was nothing like the chemical emotions we normally feel as human beings. In fact, in that moment I knew I couldn't even feel those normal human emotions. I'd evolved beyond them. I did, however, feel love, although it was an evolved form of love that was not chemical, but electric. I felt almost as though I was on fire, passionately in love with life. I was in an incredibly pure form of joy. I was also walking around my backyard in the middle of winter with no shoes and no jacket, yet I was so aware of the feeling of the cold that it was actually intensely enjoyable. I didn't have an opinion about how ice cold the ground under my feet was. I just loved having my feet touch the frozen grass on the earth, and I felt very connected to both the feeling and the grass. I understood that if I entertained the typical thoughts and judgments I normally would have about being cold, it would cause me to create a sense of polarity, dividing the energy I was experiencing. If I judged it, I would lose the feeling of wholeness. The amazing feeling of energy that I was experiencing inside my body was so much greater than the conditions in my surrounding environment, the cold. And as a result, I effortlessly embraced the cold with zeal. It was simply life. In fact, it was so pleasurable that I didn't want the moment to end. I wanted it to last forever. I walked as this upgraded version of myself with strength and knowingness. I felt very empowered and calm, yet overflowing with joy for existence and love for life. Passing through my garden, I intentionally walked on huge basalt columns that were laid on their sides, stacked like huge stairs to create levels to set at the fire pit. I loved the experience of walking barefoot on those huge pieces of stone. I truly honored their magnificence. As I continued walking, I approached a fountain that I had built, and I smiled at the memory of my brother and me creating such a marvel. Suddenly, I saw a tiny woman in a glowing white garment. She was no more than 2 feet tall, and she was standing a little behind the fountain with another woman of normal size who was dressed similarly and was also radiant and full of light. The other woman stood in the background observing, seemingly acting as the tiny woman's protector. When I looked at the tiny woman, she turned to me and gazed into my eyes. I felt an even stronger energy of love as if she were sending it to me. Even as this evolved version of myself, I realized I had never felt anything like that before. The feelings of wholeness and love amplified exponentially. And I thought to myself, wow, is there even more love than the love I was just experiencing moments ago? It wasn't at all a romantic love. It was more of that exhilarating, electrifying energy, and it was being awakened from inside of me. I knew she was acknowledging that there was indeed even more love within me to experience. I also knew she was more evolved than I was. When I felt that electricity, it carried a message to look toward the kitchen window, and I instantly remembered why I was there. I turned and looked into the kitchen where my present self, a few hours before I went to the couch to relax, was busy washing dishes. From the backyard, I smiled. I was so in love with him. I saw his sincerity. I saw his struggles. I saw his passion. I saw his love, I saw his mind busy, as always, constantly attempting to dovetail concepts into meaning, and among other things, I saw some of his future. Like a great parent, I was proud of him, and I had nothing but admiration for who he was in that moment. As I was feeling that intense energy increase inside of me while I observed him, I witnessed him suddenly stop washing the dishes and look out the window, staring out and panning the backyard. While I was still my future self, I was able to remember the moment as my present self, and I remembered that I had indeed stopped and looked outside in that instant because I felt a spontaneous feeling of love in my chest, and I sensed that I was being watched or that someone was outside. I further recalled that while I was washing a glass, I actually leaned forward to minimize the glaze in the window from the kitchen light above me, and peered into the darkness for a few minutes before returning to the remaining items in the sink. My future self was doing to my present self what the beautiful, luminous lady had done to me moments before. Now I understood why she was there. And like looking at the child in the previous scene, once again, the love that my future self was feeling for my present self somehow connected me to my future self. My future me was there to call my present self to that future, and I knew that it was love that made that bond possible. The evolved version of me had such a sense of knowing. The paradox is that it is all me living at the same time. In fact, there is an infinite number of me's, not just the one in the past, the one in the present, and the one in the future. There are so many more possible me's in the realm of infinity, and there is not just one infinity, but multiple infinities. And all of this is happening in the eternal now. When I came back to physical reality as we know it on the couch, which paled in comparison to the other dimensional world I was just in, my first thought was, wow, my view of reality is so limited. The rich inner experience provided such a sense of clarity and the understanding that my beliefs, that is, what I thought I knew about life, God, myself, time, space, and what is even possible to experience in this infinite realm, was so very limited, and I hadn't even realized it until that moment. I knew I was like an infant with little comprehension of the magnitude of how big this thing we call reality is. I understood without fear or anxiety what the phrase, the unknown, meant for the first time in my life. And I knew I would never be the same person again. I'm sure you can imagine that when something like this happens, trying to explain it to your family or friends suggests some chemical imbalance in the brain. I was hesitant to talk about the event to anyone because I didn't even have the words to describe the experience, and I didn't want to jinx it from happening again. For months, I was very preoccupied with reviewing the entire process that I thought may have created the experience. I was also mystified about the concept of time, and I couldn't stop thinking about it. Aside from the paradigm shift about the eternal moment in time, I discovered something more. I realized after the transcendental event that night, when I came back to the world of three dimensions, that the whole experience had transpired in about 10 minutes. I had just lived two extensive events, and it should have taken much more time for the entire experience to unfold. This time dilation further piqued my interest in committing more of my energy to investigating what had happened to me. Once I understood more, I hoped I might be able to reproduce the experience. For days after that important night, the center of my chest was electric in the same way I had felt when the beautiful, tiny woman activated something within me. I kept thinking, how can this feeling still be lingering inside of me unless something real happened? When I put my attention on the center of my chest, I noticed the feeling amplify. Understandably, I wasn't very interested in any social interaction during this period, because the people and conditions in the outer world distracted from that feeling in my inner world, and the special feeling diminished. In time, it finally faded completely, but I never stopped thinking about the idea that there is always more love to experience, and that the energy I had embraced in that realm still lived within me. I wanted to activate it again, but I didn't know how. For a long time, even though I tried and tried to reproduce the experience, nothing happened. I now realize that the expectation of the same outcome, combined with the frustration of trying to force it to happen, is the worst combination for creating another mystical experience, or anything for that matter. I became lost in my own personal analysis, trying to figure out how it occurred and how I could make it happen again. I decided to add a few new approaches. Instead of trying to recreate the experience in the evening, I decided to wake up early in the morning and meditate. Since melatonin levels are the highest between 1 a.m. and 4 a.m., the mystical chemical metabolites of melatonin are the very substrates responsible for creating a lucid event. I decided I would practice my inner work at 4 every morning. Before I share what happened next, I want to ask you to keep in mind that this was an unusually difficult time in my life. I was deciding whether it was worth it for me to continue to teach. I'd experienced a fair amount of chaos in my life after appearing in the 2004 documentary What the Bleep Do We Know? I was considering stepping away from the public world and disappearing into a simpler life. It seemed so much easier just to walk away. Living a past incarnation in the present moment. One morning, about an hour and a half after I started my meditation in a seated position, I finally reclined. I put some pillows under my knees so I wouldn't fall asleep too quickly, allowing me to linger between wakefulness and sleep. As I lay down, I simply put my attention in the place the pineal gland occupies in my head. But this time, instead of trying to make something happen, I just let go and said to myself, "Whatever." Apparently, that was the magic word. I know what that means now. I surrendered, got out of the way, let go of any specific outcome, and simply opened up to possibility. The next thing I knew, I was experiencing myself as a stout man in a very hot region of the world that seemed to be what we now call Greece or Turkey. The terrain was rocky, the ground was parched, and stone buildings like those in Greco-Roman times were interspersed with many small tents made of brightly colored fabrics. I was wearing a one-piece skirted burlap garment that fell from my shoulders to my mid-thighs, and I had a thick rope tied around my waist like a belt. I wore sandals roped up to my calves. I had thick, curly hair, and my body felt strong. My shoulders were broad, and my arms and legs were muscular. I was a philosopher and a long-time student of some charismatic movement. I was simultaneously the self in that experience and my present self observing me in that particular time and space. Again, I was way more conscious than normal. I was super conscious. All my senses were heightened and I was very aware of everything. I could smell the familiar musk of my body and could taste the salt of my perspiration dripping from my face. I loved the taste. I felt grounded in the physicality and strength of my body. I was aware of deep pain in my right shoulder, but it did not consume my attention. I saw the brightness of the blue sky and the richness of the green trees and mountains, as if I were living in technicolor. I heard seagulls in the distance, and I knew I was near a large body of water. I was on a pilgrimage and mission of sorts. I was traveling about the country teaching the philosophy that I had studied and lived by my whole life. I was under the tutelage of a grand master whom I loved very deeply because of the care, patience, and wisdom he had given me for so many years. It was my time now to be initiated and to deliver a message to change the minds and hearts of the culture. I knew that the message I was disseminating was counter to the current beliefs of that time, and that the government and religious orders of the day would challenge me. The main message of the philosophy I studied would free people from living in any type of obligation to something or someone outside of them. It would also inspire individuals to demonstrate a code of principles that would empower them to have more enriched and meaningful lives. I was passionate about this idealism, and I worked daily to live in alignment with the doctrines. Of course, the message would omit the need for religion and for any dependence on governments, and it would free people from personal pain and suffering. As the scene came to life, I had just finished addressing a crowd in a relatively populated village. The gathering was just breaking up when suddenly, several men quickly moved through the masses to arrest me. Before I could even try to escape, I was seized. I knew that they had planned their strategy well. If they had begun to move about while I had been talking to the crowd, I would have spotted them. They timed it perfectly. I surrendered without resistance, and they took me to a prison cell where I was left alone. Locked in a small stone cube with narrow slits for windows, I sat there knowing my destiny. Nothing I could do would prepare me for what was about to happen. Within 2 days, I was taken to the center of the city where hundreds of people gathered. Many of them, the same people who had listened to me speak just a few days earlier. But now, they eagerly anticipated the chance to watch my trial and impending torture. I was stripped to a small cloth undergarment, and then strapped to a large horizontal stone slab with large grooves notched into the corners through which ropes slid. The ropes had metal cuffs on the ends that were fastened to my wrists and ankles. Then it began. A man standing to my left started to crank a lever that moved the slab slowly from a horizontal position forward to a more vertical position. As the stone block moved upward, the ropes pulled my limbs tighter in all four directions. When I made it to about 45 degrees, the real pain began. Someone who seemed to be a magistrate yelled out, asking me if I would continue teaching my philosophy. I did not look up or answer. He then ordered the man to crank the lever further. At a certain point, I started to hear audible noises and pops, evidence of my spine dislocating in certain areas. As the observer of this scene, I watched the look on my face as the pain increased. It was like looking into a mirror and seeing myself. I became acutely aware that it was me on that slab. The metal cuffs around my wrists and ankles now tore into my skin and the sharp metal burned. I was bleeding. One of my shoulders dislocated and I heaved and grunted in pain. My body was convulsing and shaking as I tried to resist the tearing of my limbs by flexing and holding my muscles tight in resistance. Letting go would have been unbearable. Suddenly, the magistrate hollered out again, asking me if I would continue to teach. I had a thought. I will agree to stop teaching, and then when they let me down from this public display of torture, I will simply start again. I reasoned that this was the right answer. It would appease the magistrate and stop the pain and my death, while enabling me to continue my mission. I slowly shook my head from side to side in silence. Then the magistrate pressed me to verbally say no, but I would not speak. He then motioned quickly to the tormentor on my left to push the crank even harder. I looked down at the man as he turned the gears with a clear intention to hurt me. I saw his face, and as we looked into each other's eyes, I, as the observer, instantly recognized this person as someone in my present life as Joe Dispenza. The same person, but in a different body. Something clicked within me as I witnessed this scene. I recognized that this tormentor is still tormenting others, including me, in my current incarnation, and I understand that person's role in my life. It was an odd, familiar feeling or knowing, and it made perfect sense. As the slab accelerated upward, my lower back snapped and my body started to lose control. That was the moment that broke me. I wept from the blinding pain and also felt such a deep sadness consume my whole being. When the weight of the heavy stone was released, it fell quickly back to the horizontal position. I lay there quivering, uncontrollably, in silence. I was then dragged back to the small prison cell where I lay curled up in the corner. For 3 days, I couldn't stop the flashbacks of my torture. I was so humiliated that I never could speak in public again. The very thought of returning to my mission created such a visceral response in my body that I stopped even thinking about it. One night they released me, and without being noticed, head down in utter shame, I disappeared. I was unable to look anyone in the eye ever again. I felt like I had failed in my mission. I spent the rest of my life in a cave by the sea, trapping fish and living in silence as a hermit. As I witnessed this poor man's plight and his choice to hide from the world, I understood that this was a message for me. I knew that in my present life I could not disappear or hide from the world again, and that my soul wanted me to see that I had to continue my work. I had to make the effort to stand up for a message and never again retract from adversity. I also recognized that I hadn't failed at all. I had done my best. I knew that the young philosopher still lived in the eternal present moment as a myriad of possible me's, and that I could change my future and his by never again being afraid to live for the truth instead of dying for it. Each of us has myriad possible incarnations that exist in the eternal present moment, all waiting to be discovered. When the mystery of the self is unveiled, we can wake up to the understanding that we are not linear beings living a linear life, but instead dimensional beings living dimensional lives. The beauty behind the infinite probabilities that await us is that the only way we can change those futures is to change ourselves in the present infinite moment. Chapter 2. The Present Moment. If you want to experience the supernatural in your own life, by healing your body, creating new opportunities you could never have imagined before, and having transcendent, mystical experiences, you first need to master the concept of the present moment, the eternal now. There's a lot of talk about being present or being in the now these days. While most people understand the basics of what that means, not to think about the future or live in the past, I want to offer you a completely different understanding of the concept. It's going to require that you get beyond the physical world, including your body, your identity and your environment, and even beyond time itself. This is where you turn possibility into reality. After all, if you don't get beyond who you think you are and the way you've been conditioned to believe the world works, it's not possible to create a new life or a new destiny. So in a very real sense, you have to get out of your own way, transcend the memory of yourself as an identity, and allow something greater than you, something mystical, to take over. In this chapter, I'm going to explain how that works. First, let's take a look at how the brain functions. When any neurological tissue in the brain or the body is activated, it creates mind. Consequently, from a neuroscientific understanding, mind is the brain in action. For instance, you have a specific mind to drive your car. You have another mind to take a shower. You have a different mind when you sing a song or listen to music. You use a specific level of mind to execute each of those complex functions because you've probably done each of these tasks thousands of times. So your brain turns on in a very specific way whenever you do any of them. When your brain is in action as you drive your car, for example, you are in fact turning on a specific sequence, pattern, and combination of neurological networks. Those neural networks, or neural nets, are simply clusters of neurons that work together as a community, just like an automatic software program or a macro, because you've done that particular action so many times. In other words, the neurons that fire together to accomplish the task become more wired together. As you consciously choose to perform the task of driving your vehicle, we could say that you are automatically selecting and instructing those neurons in your brain to turn on to create a level of mind. For the most part, your brain is a product of the past. It has been shaped and molded to become a living record of everything you have learned and experienced up to this point in your life. Learning, from a neuroscientific standpoint, is when neurons in your brain assemble to form thousands of synaptic connections, and those connections then assemble into complex, three-dimensional neurological networks. Think of learning as your brain getting an upgrade. When you pay attention to knowledge or information, and it makes sense to you, this interaction with the environment leaves biological impressions in your brain. When you experience something new, your senses write the story neurologically in your brain, and even more neurons come together to make even more enriched connections, upgrading your brain even further. Experiences not only enhance the brain's circuitry, but they also create emotions. Think of emotions as the chemical residue from past experiences, or chemical feedback. The stronger the emotional quotient from an event in your life, the more the experience leaves a lasting impression in your brain. That's how long-term memories are formed. So if learning means making new connections in your brain, memories are when you maintain those connections. The more you repeat a thought, choice, behavior, experience or emotion, the more those neurons fire and wire together, and the more they will sustain a long-term relationship. In Anna's story in the previous chapter, you learn most of your experiences come from your interaction with your external environment. Since your senses plug you into the external environment and neurologically record the narrative in your brain, when you experience a highly charged emotional event, bad or good, That moment becomes embossed neurologically in your brain as a memory. Therefore, when an experience changes how you normally feel chemically and heightens your attention to what caused it, you will associate a specific person or thing with where your body is at a particular time and place. That's how you create memories, by interacting with the outer world. It's safe to say that the only place the past actually exists is in your brain and in your body. How your past becomes your future. Let's take a closer look at what happens biochemically inside your body when you think a thought or feel an emotion. When you think a thought or have a memory, a biochemical reaction begins in your brain, causing the brain to release certain chemical signals. That's how immaterial thoughts literally become matter. They become chemical messengers. These chemical signals make your body feel exactly the way you were just thinking. Once you notice you are feeling a particular way, then you generate more thoughts equal to how you're feeling, and then you release more chemicals from your brain to make you feel the way you've been thinking. For example, if you have a fearful thought, you start to feel fear. The moment you feel fear, that emotion influences you to think more fearful thoughts, and those thoughts trigger the release of even more chemicals in the brain and body to make you continue to feel more fear. The next thing you know, you get caught in a loop where your thinking creates feeling, and your feeling creates thinking. If thoughts are the vocabulary of the brain, and feelings are the vocabulary of the body, and the cycle of how you think and feel becomes your state of being, then your entire state of being is in the past. When you fire and wire the same circuits in your brain over and over again because you keep thinking the same thoughts, you are hardwiring your brain into the same patterns. As a result, your brain becomes an artifact of your past thinking, and in time it becomes easier to automatically think in the same ways. At the same time, as you repeatedly feel the same emotions over and over again, since, as I just said, emotions are the vocabulary of the body and the chemical residue of past experiences, you are conditioning your body into the past. So now let's look at what that means for you on a day-to-day basis. Given what you just learned about feelings and emotions being the chemical end products of past events, the moment you wake up in the morning and search for the familiar feeling called you, you are starting your day in the past. So when you start to think about your problems, those problems which are connected to the memories of past experiences of different people or things at certain times and places, create familiar feelings such as unhappiness, futility, sadness, pain, grief, anxiety, worry, frustration, unworthiness, or guilt. If those emotions are driving your thoughts and you cannot think greater than how you feel, then you are also thinking in the past. And if those familiar emotions influence the choices you are going to make that day, the behaviors you are going to exhibit, or the experiences you are going to create for yourself, then you are going to appear predictable, and your life is going to stay the same. Now let's say after you wake up, you turn off your alarm, and as you lie there in bed, you check your Facebook, your Instagram, your WhatsApp, your Twitter, your texts, your emails, and then the news. Now you are really remembering who you are as you reaffirm your personality and connect your past, present, personal reality. Then you go to the bathroom, you use the toilet, brush your teeth, take a shower, get dressed, and then head for the kitchen. You drink some coffee and eat breakfast. Maybe you watch the news or check your email again. It's the same routine you follow every day. Then you drive to work using the same old route, and when you get there, you interact with the same coworkers you saw the day before. You spend your day performing pretty much the same duties you performed yesterday. You might even react to the same challenges at work with the same emotions. Then after work, you drive home. Maybe you stop at the same grocery store and buy the food you like and always eat. You cook the same food for dinner and watch the same television show at the same time while sitting in the same place in your living room. Then you get ready for bed in the same way you always do. You brush your teeth with your right hand starting from the upper right side of your mouth. You crawl into the same side of the bed. Maybe you read a little, and then you go to sleep. If you keep doing these same routines over and over again, they will become a habit. A habit is a redundant set of automatic, unconscious thoughts, behaviors, and emotions that you acquire through frequent repetition. Basically, it means your body is now on autopilot, running a series of programs, and over time, your body becomes the mind. You've done this routine so many times that your body automatically knows how to do certain things better than your brain or conscious mind. You just switch on the autopilot and go unconscious, which means you'll wake up the next morning and essentially do the same things all over again. In a very real sense, your body is dragging you into the same predictable future based on what you have been repeatedly doing in the same familiar past. You will think the same thoughts and then make the same choices that lead to the same behaviors, that create the same experiences, that produce the same emotions. Over time, you've created a set of hardwired neurological networks in the brain, and you have emotionally conditioned your body to live in the past. And that past becomes your future. If you were looking at a timeline of your day starting with waking up in the morning and continuing until you go to bed that night, you could pick up that timeline of yesterday or today, your past, and place it in the space reserved for tomorrow, the future, because essentially the same actions you took today are the ones you were going to take tomorrow, and the day after that, and the day after that. Let's face it, if you keep the same routine as yesterday, it makes sense that your tomorrow is going to be a lot like your yesterday. Your future is just a rerun of your past. That's because your yesterday is creating your tomorrow. Take a look at figure 2.1. Each of those vertical lines represent the same thought that leads to the same choice that initiates an automatic behavior, that creates a known experience that produces a familiar feeling or an emotion. If you keep reproducing the same sequence, in time, all those individual steps merge into one automatic program. This is how you lose your free will to a program. The arrow represents an unknown experience dropping in somewhere between your driving to work in traffic, knowing you are going to be late again, and you trying to stop by the dry cleaners on your way. We could say that your mind and body are in the known, the same predictable future based on what you did in the same familiar past. And in that known certain future, there's no room for the unknown. In fact, if something new happened, if something unknown were to unfold in your life at that moment to change the same predictable timeline of your day, you'd probably be annoyed at the disruption of your routine. You'd likely consider it troublesome, problematic, and downright inconvenient. You might say, "Can you come back tomorrow? This is not the right time." The fact is, there's no room for the unknown in a predictable life. But being predictable is not how the unknown works. The unknown is unfamiliar, uncertain, but it's also exciting because it occurs in ways you cannot expect or anticipate. So let me ask you, how much room in your routine, predictable life do you have for the unknown? By staying in the known, following the same sequence each day of thinking the same thoughts, making the same choices, demonstrating the same programmed habits, recreating the same experiences that stamp the same networks of neurons into the same patterns to reaffirm the same familiar feeling called you, you are repeating the same level of mind over and over again. In time, your brain becomes automatically programmed to do any one of those particular sequences more easily and effortlessly the next time, and then the next time, and so on. As each of these individual steps merge into one complete step, thinking a familiar thought of an experience of somebody or something at some place in some time, will automatically create the anticipation of the feeling of the experience. If you can predict the feeling of any experience, you are still in the know. For instance, the thought of having a meeting with the same team of people you have worked with for years can automatically cause you to call up the emotion of what the future event will feel like. When you can predict the feeling of that future event, because you've had enough past experiences to make it known to you, you are probably going to be creating more of the same. And of course, you are right. But that's because you are the same. By the same means, if you are in the automatic program and cannot predict the feeling of an experience in your life, you will probably be hesitant to engage it. We need to look at one more aspect of thinking and feeling to get the full picture of what's happening when we keep living in the same state of being. This thinking-feeling loop also produces a measurable electromagnetic field that surrounds our physical bodies. In fact, our bodies are always emitting light, energy, or frequencies that carry a specific message, information, or intention. By the way, when I say light, I am not just referring to the light we see, but to all spectrums of light, including X-rays, cell phone waves, and microwaves. In the same way, we also receive vital information that is carried on different frequencies. So we are always sending and receiving electromagnetic energy. Here's how that works. When we think a thought, those networks of neurons that fire in our brain create electrical charges. When those thoughts also cause a chemical reaction that results in a feeling or an emotion, as well as when a familiar feeling or emotion is driving our thoughts, those feelings create magnetic charges. They merge with the thoughts that create the electric charges to produce a specific electromagnetic field equal to your state of being. Think of emotions as energy in motion. When someone experiencing a strong emotion walks into a room, their energy, aside from their body language, is often very palpable. We have all felt another person's energy and intent when they were angry or very frustrated. We felt it because they were emitting a strong signal of energy that carried specific information. The same is true of a very sexual person, a person who is suffering, or a person who has a calm, loving energy. All those energies can be sensed and felt. As you might expect, different emotions produce different frequencies. The frequencies of creative, elevated emotions like love, joy, and gratitude are much higher than the emotions of stress, such as fear and anger, because they carry different levels of conscious intent and energy. See figure 2.2, which details some of the different frequencies associated with various emotional states. You'll read more about this concept later in the book. So if we are recreating the past day after day, thinking the same thoughts and feeling the same emotions, we are broadcasting the same electromagnetic field over and over again, sending out the same energy with the same message. From the perspective of energy and information, this means the same energy of our past continues to carry the same information, which then keeps creating the same future. Our energy, then, is essentially equal to our past. The only way we can change our lives is to change our energy, to change the electromagnetic field we are constantly broadcasting. In other words, to change our state of being, we have to change how we think and how we feel. If where you place your attention is where you place your energy, a key concept you'll read more about later in this chapter, then the moment you place your attention on a familiar emotion, your attention and your energy are in the past. If those familiar emotions are connected to a memory of some past event involving a person or an object at a particular place and time, then your attention and your energy are in the past as well. As a consequence, you are siphoning your energy out of the present moment into your past. By the same means, if you start to think about all the people you have to see, the things you have to do, and the places you have to go at certain times in your routine day, you are siphoning your attention and energy into a predictable, known future. Take a look at figure 2.3, which illustrates this point. All of your energy is now completely commingled with those known experiences in that specific line of time. Your energy is creating more of the same, and your body is going to follow your mind to the same events in your same reality. Your energy is being directed out of the present moment and into the past and the future. As a result, you have very little energy left to create an unknown experience in a new timeline. Figure 2.3 also shows how the electromagnetic energy you emanate is a vibrational match with everything known to you. So as you start your day, when you have the thought of the toilet, the next thing you know, there you are, walking toward the toilet. Then you have the thought of the shower, and you find yourself in the shower adjusting the water temperature. You have the thought of the coffee maker, and you are projecting your attention and energy to the coffee maker. And as you automatically walk to the kitchen to make your morning cup of java, once again your body is following your mind. And if you've done that for the last 22 years, your body is going to effortlessly coast right over there. Your body is always following your mind, but in this case, it's been repeatedly following your mind to the known. That's because that's where your attention, and therefore your energy, is. So now let me ask you this. Could it ever be possible for your body to start following your mind to the unknown? If so, you can see that you would have to change where you put your attention, and that would lead to changing your energy, which would require you to change how you think and how you feel long enough for something new to happen. While it may sound incredible, this is indeed possible. It makes sense that just as your body has been following your mind to every known experience in your life, like the coffee maker each morning, if you were to start investing your attention and energy into the unknown, your body would then be able to follow your mind into the unknown, a new experience in your future. Priming your mind and body for a new future. If you are familiar with my work, you know that I'm in love with the concept of mental rehearsal. I'm fascinated by how we can change the brain as well as the body by thought alone. Think about that for a moment. If you focus your attention on specific imagery in your mind and become very present with a sequence of repeated thoughts and feelings, your brain and body will not know the difference between what is occurring in the outer world and what is happening in your inner world. So when you are fully engaged and focused, the inner world of imagination will appear as an outer world experience, and your biology will change accordingly. That means you can make your brain and body look as if a physical experience has already happened without having the actual experience. What you put your attention on and mentally rehearse over and over again not only becomes who you are from a biological perspective, it also determines your future. Here's a good example. A team of Harvard researchers took a group of volunteers who had never before played the piano and divided the group in half. One half practiced a simple five-finger piano exercise for 2 hours a day over a period of 5 days. The remaining half did the same thing, but just by imagining they were sitting at the piano, without physically moving their fingers in any way. The before and after brain scans showed that both groups created a dramatic number of new neural circuits and new neurological programming in the region of their brains that controls finger movements, even though one group did so by thought alone. Think about this. The folks who mentally rehearsed the actions had brains that looked like the experience had already happened, even though they never lifted a finger. If you were to put them in front of a piano after 5 days of mental rehearsal, many of them would be able to play the exercise they imagined pretty well, even though they had never before tickled the ivories. By mentally imagining the activity every day, they installed the neurological hardware in preparation for the experience. They repeatedly fired and wired those brain circuits with their attention and intention, and over time the hardware became an automatic software program in their brains, and it became easier to do the next time. So if they were to start to play after 5 days of mental practice, their behaviors would become easily aligned with their conscious intentions because they prime their brains for the experience ahead of time. That's how powerful the mind can be once trained. Similar studies show the same kinds of results with muscle training. In a pioneering study at the Cleveland Clinic, 10 research subjects between the ages of 20 and 35 imagined flexing one of their biceps as hard as they could in 5 training sessions a week for 12 weeks. Every other week, the researchers recorded the subjects' electrical brain activity during their sessions and measured their muscle strength. By the end of the study, the subjects had increased their bicep strength by 13.5%, even though they hadn't actually been using their muscles at all.